Everyone for joining us. We'll get started. Thanks for joining us for this discussion about how to safeguard modern bioscience and biotechnology to prevent catastrophic biological events. This topic feels particularly pertinent with recent events such as the White House executive order launching a national biotech and biomanufacturing initiative, and also with the upcoming Biological Weapons Convention Review Conference. So I'm really excited to say we have two talented experts with us today who I'd like to introduce, and I'll start with Jamie. So Dr. Jamie Yassif is a Vice President of the Nuclear Threat Initiative's Global Biological Policy and Programs. NTI is, of course, an organization long interested in protecting the world from catastrophic events. And at NTI, Jamie oversees an important portfolio of biosecurity projects, which we will hear about today. And before this, she was Open Philanthropy's Biosecurity and Pandemic Preparedness Program Officer. In this role, she deployed millions in grant funding to build and grow the biosecurity field, and she also served as the policy advisor to the U.S. Department of Defense. And all of this work is informed by her prior training as a biophysicist. So she'll start us off today with a presentation that outlines where biorisk comes from, how governance can help mitigate these risks, and then we'll have a fireside discussion with Jamie and Dr. Beth Cameron, who's our other guest for today. So Beth, I'm so excited to have you here with us. You've had such a rich career in the biosecurity space, and I know that I won't be able to highlight all of the things that you've done in a brief introduction, but I'll try and hit the highlights. So Beth has spent over a decade in government in various senior roles overseeing the expansion of threat reduction programs and was actually awarded a medal for exceptional civilian service for this important work. She's also served on the White House National Security Council as Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense, and she's now a professor at the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health. So for our fireside chat, as the audience, you can submit questions via swap card, and I'll try and pick the most popular questions as long as we don't have any glitches. And thank you again, both of you, for joining us today, and I'll hand it over to Jamie.
Great. Thank you. Okay, here we go. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I hope you've had a rich 2 days of discussions here at EA Global DC. I think it's so exciting that EA Global has come to Washington, and I hope it comes back again in the coming years. I'm really excited to have our discussion today about biosecurity and safeguarding modern bioscience and biotech and how that relates to reducing global catastrophic biological risks. As mentioned, I work at NTI. NTI is a nonpartisan, nonprofit global security organization that's focused on reducing nuclear and biological risks that imperil humanity. But today we're going to talk about the bio portion of our work. So just a quick overview here, the three big sections of the talk that I'll be going through in the next 15 or 20 minutes. First of all, ideas about sources of global catastrophic biological risks. What is a GCBR? Where do we think the GCBRs come from? Second, what are some of the things that we can do to reduce GCBRs, including, importantly, strengthening biotech governance to prevent these kinds of events? And third, I'm going to talk a little bit about the International Biosecurity and Biosafety Initiative for Science, or IBIS, which is an initiative at NTI that we're developing to tackle this really important challenge. So sources of GCBRs. Okay, so first of all, what is a GCBR? I think a lot of folks in the room probably have thoughts about what this is, but I think just for level setting, it's useful to offer a definition. This is my personal definition that's informed by the way that the effective altruism community thinks about it. It will probably seem quite familiar. So one way to think about it is a biological event of tremendous scale that could cause severe damage to human civilization, potentially derailing it or threatening its long-term survival. So big events, some people define GCBRs in terms of numbers, but those numbers sort of range, and so a qualitative definition I find is most helpful. Okay, so where might a GCBR come from? So generally speaking, large biological events could come from three buckets of sources: a naturally emerging pandemic, some sort of accidental misuse of biology that spreads globally, or deliberate misuse, a bioweapons attack. And a deliberate attack could come either from a state or a non-state actor, and those are qualitatively quite different in terms of how we think about that. My personal view and our view at NTI, generally speaking, is that is that human-caused pandemics, either via an accident or a deliberate event, is more likely to lead to a GCVR-scale event than naturally emerging infectious disease outbreak. I would say that there's some uncertainty about that. I think it's plausible that a naturally emerging pandemic could lead to a GCVR, but we're more focused. We think that an accidental or deliberate event is more likely to lead to that. And in fact, while we work across all three of these areas in our work on the bio team at NTI, I think we have a strong comparative advantage on countering human-caused pandemic risks. And the other thing I'll say at the outset is most of the information I'm going to focus on today is me focused on prevention of GCVRs and pandemics. There's a lot of important work in early detection and response, which is absolutely critical to the layer defense that we need to guard against pandemic risks. But I'm going to focus on prevention today just for the sake of time. And also because a lot of our work on the bio team is focused on prevention. Okay, so what do we do about GCVR risks? As I said, they can come from states and non-state actors. Generally speaking, if you're thinking about deliberate risks, the issue, you know, what you're most worried about is when there is an intent to cause a large biological event overlapping with the capability to do so. When you have those two things resident in the same actor or organization, that's when there's a danger, and so you want to reduce the overlap. And so you can either shape intent, meaning make it unattractive, or you can constrain capabilities, make it difficult to execute in practice. I try to think about this in a structured way and think about, well, which different actors are amenable to these different types of interventions. In my view, it's really hard to constrain the capabilities of powerful states and prevent them from having access to the goods and services that could enable them to either acquire or engineer a powerful pathogen. And so you really have to shape their intent, make a bioweapon development or use prospect unattractive to them. For non-state actors, I think it's the converse. You have to assume that there's going to be a non-state actor out there that's not deterrable, that is going to be interested in creating a large biological event or a GCVR. But it is easier to constrain their capabilities. And so this is sort of a rough approximation of how I divide the space. I also think it may be possible on the margins to constrain the capabilities of some states if they're subject to sanctions or they have fewer resources, but I think that's a little uncertain, and I don't think that is as impactful of an intervention to deal with states, generally speaking. The other thing I wanted to flag is that this talk is not going to cover all of this. This is a lot of, if you unpack this, this would be an hour-long talk. I'm going to focus primarily on the constraining capabilities piece. Happy to talk about shaping intent during the Q&A or after our discussion. Okay, so constraining capabilities, the way you can think about it is strengthening biotechnology governance to prevent GCVRs, to prevent accidental or deliberate misuse of the tools of modern bioscience and biotechnology. So how do we do that? What are the tools at our disposal? How can we really meaningfully make progress on this important issue? So before I get into how to solve the problem, I want to spend a few slides admiring the problem, explaining like what exactly we're talking about when we talk about emerging biorisks that are associated with rapid technology advances. And the first thing I want to start by saying is that, you know, we need to recognize that ultimately a lot of these technology advances are extremely have a tremendous potential, and then they're, you know, net positive. There's, you know, tremendous potential for advancing human health and pandemic preparedness, driving economic development, advancing agriculture, finding solutions to climate change. And that's why the Biden administration just announced the executive order for building the U.S. bioeconomy, because all this tremendous potential. And we have to remember that when we're talking about this, and we have to enable that to flourish. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that these developments also have unique risks that we have to understand and manage to safeguard the benefits. And so why, you know, what is that coming from? So there are a number of technology developments that we've been seeing as part of this revolution in bioscience and biotechnology in the 21st century that's been going on for decades and is accelerating. So first of all, it is now easier, cheaper, and faster to read, write, and edit DNA and RNA, which is the fundamental blueprint for all living things on Earth. When we say reading, we mean DNA sequencing. Writing is synthesis. Editing, you know, it's been possible to edit genomes for quite a while. recent development of CRISPR technology enables us to do that more easily and sort of spot edit parts of genomes of different organisms. And so that has broadened access to that capability to more people and more organizations. And in terms of DNA synthesis, there are companies all around the world that provide those services. I've just included a couple examples on the slide. Twist Bioscience is out on the West Coast in California. BGI is in China. But this capability is distributed globally. So, but it's not just about DNA and RNA. There are also a lot of other technology advances that are happening in parallel. So, for example, AI and robotics are enabling automation and experimentation at scale, which is speeding up innovation. We're seeing cloud labs. So, for example, Emerald Labs out in San Francisco. There are cloud labs where customers can order experiments done in a giant automated lab to create data or materials for them. And then on the horizon, we also see emerging capabilities using AI to predict protein structure and even design protein structure. So that's still nascent, but I think it's an example of an important development that we're going to want to safeguard because it changes our ability to fundamentally control biology. Right? So I think basically the bottom line is it's easier to generate pathogens from scratch or to modify them in terms of how virulent they are, how transmissible they are among humans, and their susceptibility to medical countermeasures. And in fact, some researchers have been using the tools that I'm talking about to do just that for legitimate scientific reasons, and they published papers on showing these developments. There are a number of examples that have been, there's been a chain of publications for at least the last decade and actually longer. So there are very famous experiments in 2012 where people took the H5N1 virus and made it which has a high mortality rate and showed how it might be transmissible among humans and published the results about how you do that. A few years ago, there were some Canadian researchers that reconstituted the horsepox virus, which is related to smallpox, using mail order DNA. And then there was a more recent paper in 2020 where they showed how you could reverse engineer the SARS-CoV-2 virus using a synthetic genomics platform. So there's a lot of controversy about these papers and whether they should have been published and whether these experiments should have been done in the first place and whether that's net beneficial or if that is like producing info hazards and hazardous materials. But the implications from a sort of biosafety and biosecurity perspective are pretty significant for this. Democratized access enables a wider range of actors to engineer pathogens. So that means that there's an increased risk that non-state actors could carry out an attack with a sophisticated pathogen. We know that non-state actors, from the recent historical record, have been interested in executing bioweapons attacks, and so we shouldn't assume that can't happen in the future. There is a baseline rate of accidental release from laboratories that's documented. More recently, United States biodefense labs accidentally shipped insufficiently inactivated anthrax spores to 194 labs around the U.S. and internationally. Fortunately, no one was injured, but that's a pretty big error. And if it had involved a more dangerous pathogen, it could have been really catastrophic. So to the extent that you're conducting dangerous experiments and there's a baseline risk of an accident, that increases the risk of a GCVR from that source. And then finally, this is more speculative, but if biosystems are more easily tunable, it increases the risk that states might find bioweapons development more attractive. I hope that's not true, but I think we have to consider that possibility. So the challenge is, we see rapid biotechnology advances. It's outpacing the ability of national governments to provide effective oversight to prevent catastrophic misuse. A clear example is the Global Health Security Index, which NTI produced in partnership with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, showed that 94% of countries around the world do not have national level oversight of dual use research in the biosciences. And at the international level, there are also gaps. There's no international organization that has its primary mission dedicated to addressing these issues and reducing these risks. So the theory of change is, pretty straightforward. We want to reduce the risk of accidents with engineered pathogens, and we want to prevent malicious actor exploitation and misuse. So on the left side, basically we want to strengthen biosafety to reduce the frequency of accidents, and we also want to avoid excessively risky research, such that when an accident happens, it's not as bad as it might otherwise be. In terms of preventing exploitation, we want to control access to materials and services and make sure only people who should have those materials have them. And we also want to prevent publication of info hazards. How do we do this? Well, I think the main argument I would make is that we have to think about this comprehensively throughout the life cycle of bioscience and biotechnology research and development. There's no single silver bullet. We have to think about this from project inception and funding through oversight of project execution at either industrial or academic research institutions. We have to think about providers of materials and services, not just, you know, DNA providers or cloud labs, pathogen repositories, those kinds of places. They need to have controls in place. And also publishers of papers, journals, and others have to be thinking about pre-funding, pre-publication biosecurity review, make sure they're not, you know, have more robust practices in place to do that effectively. Okay, so what are we doing about this at NTI? So we're doing a lot. The primary priority for us in this area is an initiative called the International Biosecurity and Biosafety Initiative for Science, or IBIS. And this is a new international organization that we're launching in 2023 that will be dedicated to this set of issues. So before I talk about the challenge, again, the rapid pace of the technology advances is making it hard for governments and international organizations to keep up. And so the action we're taking is engaging public sector and private sector stakeholders to really develop stronger global biosecurity norms and also practical tools to concretely reduce risk at all these different points throughout the life cycle that I was just talking about. And so this organization is called IBIS. Here's the nifty logo that we developed for it as part of creating the identity of this new organization. We're currently working to build political support for it and raise awareness of it as we work towards launch of the organization next year. And we have recruited an executive director. I'm not going to share who that is right now, but we're pretty excited. So you can watch this space. We'll be making an announcement soon. So the mission of this organization is to work collaboratively with global partners to strengthen biosecurity norms and to develop innovative tools to uphold them. That's the what the organization will do. The second part of the mission is why. So the underlying motivation is to safeguard science and to reduce the risk of catastrophic events that could result from either deliberate abuse or accidental misuse of bioscience and biotechnology. The initial focus of the of IBIS, and so the mission is quite broadly defined, but the initial scope of work will be very focused on the concrete work of DNA synthesis screening. So that's part of this continuum of interventions throughout the life cycle. And so the problem we're trying to solve is that basically DNA synthesis is getting faster, cheaper, and more accessible, which is great, but security provisions to make sure that the building blocks of dangerous pathogens don't fall into the hands of malicious actors, that the screening process is currently voluntary. So there's an estimated 80% of global market share that's screened. The International Gene Synthesis Consortium is a consortium of companies that sort of team up together to implement those practices in their respective companies, but it's not legally required, it's totally voluntary. And so the question is, should that continue to be the case, or should we have more rigorous requirements? To make matters more complex, it's looking like parts of this will start to become distributed because there are now benchtop synthesis devices that are coming online and becoming commercially available, which means that you can start to print DNA on your benchtop in your lab. And so it's still early days for this technology. They can only print short pieces, and the sequence fidelity still needs to improve. But as these capabilities improve over time, this is going to be a significant development. We need to think hard about how we safeguard these benchtop devices to make sure that we don't have a glaring hole in the control regime for DNA synthesis writ large. Just in the interest of time, I'm going to pass through this really quickly. I will say, you know, we at NTI, we jointly published a report in January 2020 with the World Economic Forum calling for action to address the challenge of DNA synthesis screening. One of the key recommendations was to establish a technical consortium, which would be focused on developing a tool to address this challenge to help companies around the world screen effectively and cheaply. We launched the technical consortium in May of 2020, which has got a lot of industry and international representation, and we have ongoing technical consortium activities. We are developing the common mechanism. We're on track to complete it this year and probably share it internationally next year. But we're also working on customer screening and integration with benchtop devices. Here's the basic idea of how the common mechanism works. You basically, and this is how companies generally screen, and this is how also the common mechanism is set up. A customer creates an account with a company, and the company needs to answer the question of whether this is a legitimate customer. Is it safe to work with them? They place an order, and then in this blue box, the company has to decide, is it okay to sell this DNA to this customer? Is this safe? Or does this raise some kind of red flag? If there's no red flag, the order is completed and it's sent out. If there's some sort of red flag, the company has to investigate whether this user in question should have access to that DNA that's associated with a pathogen or a toxin. And if it passes the test, then they'll send the order out, and if it doesn't, they'll deny the order. That happens pretty rarely, but it does happen sometimes. The common mechanism, its components, are like pretty simple. There's reference databases. So when the DNA order comes in, the company basically compares the sequence of the order with a set of reference databases to see if there's a match to anything dangerous. There's an algorithm that does that comparison. And so we are building those tools. We are probably going to have a decision support system that goes with that, so it just displays the relevant information to the user, but that's in progress. And as I said, we have a really talented team of technical experts leading this effort. Our technical lead is Nicole Wheeler, who's based at the University of Birmingham and associated with the Alan Turing Institute in the UK, and she's been really fantastic in helping us build this tool. And then I'll just note that there are a number of other initiatives that IBIS can take on above and beyond DNA synthesis screening. The ones that are more mature are near the top of the list. We don't have time to get into this right now, but we can talk about it during the Q&A. And I'll just leave you with this. Thank you so much. This QR code, you could try it out. This should take you to the project page on the NTI website that describes IBIS briefly, if you want to learn more. And then there's a link to our bio team project page, and then NTI's Twitter handle and my Twitter handle. So thank you so much for your interest in this topic, and looking forward to the discussion.
All right, great. Thank you so much. So just to remind the audience, you can ask any questions that you would like through the SwapCard app, but I have a couple of questions that I would like to start with. So you mentioned, and I also mentioned in the introduction, this new executive order that President Biden has signed to kick off an effort to build a big, broad U.S. bioeconomy. And it talks a little bit about domestic manufacturing, bio-based products, investing in biotech R&D. It is very broad. And I just wanted to ask, maybe asking Beth first, as we're accelerating investment in this space, how do you think about ensuring that we're continuing to think about biosecurity at the same time?
Yeah, so thanks, and thanks, Jamie. That was a great setup for what I hope will be a great conversation with all of you. So please ask hard questions through the swap card. First and foremost, I think that building the bioeconomy and U.S. leadership in building the bioeconomy is an incredible, and global leadership in building the global bioeconomy is an incredible opportunity to actually do more on the biosafety and biosecurity front, because it is an emphasis in building technology. And at the front end of all of that technology development, we now have an opportunity with new investments going in to actually make the case that biosafety and biosecurity should be on the front end, and that it should be an actual technical competency, not just a policy competency that people like us are talking about here on the stage, but something that people who are actually actively putting capital, funding, investment into technology development for lots of reasons, because they want to develop the tech, because they're interested in global development, because they're interested in global health, because they're interested in medical countermeasures to stop the GCBR once and if it starts. For all of those reasons, those same people need to get interested in funding technical innovation in biosafety and biosecurity. The executive order has, I'm really pleased to say, I think it's section 9, I might be wrong about that, but double check, there's a section that includes biosafety and biosecurity as a new initiative in technical innovation at the Department of Health and Human Services. Executive orders cannot provide funding, but this is a hook for new investments in the bioeconomy that the U.S. puts forward to include biosafety and biosecurity provisions on the front end. It's also a hook for us to show partners around the world, for all of you that may not be coming from the United States, to show that this was part of our work to build the bioeconomy. don't know if you want to add to that,
Jamie. I mean, I'll just add that I think it's the latest step in a long progression of steps in this area. They're just showing that countries around the world are prioritizing bioeconomy investment because they think it's critical to their economic development, generally speaking. And I think that that both makes the case for why these guardrails are critical, that we, because there's accelerating investment and growth, we need to think about securing these important resources. But I agree with you, it also creates an opportunity. I think as various governments are thinking about this, it creates an opening for us at NTI and also IBIS to help them think about how to build the tools, and that's important.
Yeah, I think this is a very large opening for an organization like IBIS as it's launching to say, look, this is exactly what we need to bring together governments, to bring together funders, to bring together the private sector all together, talking about how we can do more, practically do more to create the tools we need to create technologies while also being really careful that we don't accidentally create the thing that we were actually trying to prevent in the first place.
Yeah. That's great. And actually, just to follow on that, it was really exciting to hear about IBIS and everything that's going towards that effort. I wonder if maybe I'll start with Jamie here. If, this is an international initiative. It involves a lot of stakeholders, and we do have other international multilateral organizations like WHO, BWC, or Biological Weapons Convention. So I was wondering, for me and for the audience, can you explain a little bit how IBIS fits into this international architecture and how you envision that, what makes it different?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, so IBIS will be an independent international organization, so it's not going to be, it will be international, but it's not going to be embedded in the UN system or WHO. We envision, though, that it's going to work very closely with both the Biological Weapons Convention and the WHO and other organizations that have shared interests. Our view is that both WHO and the BWC are doing really important work in this area. For example, the science division at WHO recently released some guidance about norms for how we can safeguard bioscience and biotechnology, and that's really important. But we think it's going to be really important to help make those norms a reality by developing concrete tools and interventions to actually reduce risk concretely, all these steps that I mentioned. And I think there's a lot of thinking we need to do to build those tools, and I think IBIS is going to be a huge part of that. So the idea is to reinforce and help implement the vision that WHO is putting forward and see if we could even strengthen those norms, take it forward even more. Likewise, the Biological Weapons Convention, I mean, really that's the international institution that embodies the norm against development and use of biological weapons, and that has a strong science and technology component, and in fact, that has been a recurring theme in conversations at the BWC. How can we at the BWC have an advisory group that's thinking about the implications of science and technology development for the BWC, both opportunities and risks? And so that is ongoing, and I'm hopeful that there's some resolution that's passed at the upcoming BWC review conference that actually creates that mechanism. And so that's great, but the BWC staff and capacity is tiny. I mean, the annual budget for the BWC is $1.5 million, which I think, as our colleagues in the effective altruism community have repeatedly pointed out, that's about the cost of running a single McDonald's franchise for a year. So they're really limited in what they can do. And again, this is not their top priority, which is why we think IBIS can really help complement and reinforce that goal, and that these set of institutions can operate as an integrated system that reinforce each other.
Yeah, I think also I just add to that really great explanation of the two systems and how IBIS can complement them. It's also critical to look at technological safety and security and recognize that neither the WHO nor the Biological Weapons Convention or its parent component in the UN, the UN Office of Disarmament Affairs, UNODA, neither of those entities have technological misuse or lab accidents or misuse of non-state actors as a main issue. They are focused on policy development. They are focused on implementation and preventing, detecting and responding to things as they happen. They're not looking at how to get upstream of technology development, misuse, whether the misuse is accidental or deliberate. And so an organization like IBIS, I think, is so essential in order to fill that crack and bring stakeholders to the table, including UNODA and WHO, to focus on this very specific practical issue that's been neglected for a really long time.
Okay, that's really helpful. It seems like A focus on biotech governance, but a broader interpretation of that is really important, and that's a gap that IBIS is filling, and also the development of practical tools around that, which leads me to my next question, which is, in terms of practical tools, you started with, or you will be starting with DNA synthesis screening. Mm-hmm. What are the other efforts that you think IBIS could potentially tackle in the future?
Sure. So there, as you could see at the end, there was a long list, but in the near term, we are working at NTI to spin up some additional pilot projects that could, if successful, mature into projects that we could hand off to IBIS in the way that we're handing off the common mechanism for DNA synthesis screening. One of the projects that's quite mature is this idea of a biosecurity funders compact. And so the problem that we're trying to solve with this project is that we feel that funders, both in government and in private philanthropies and the private sector, are perhaps not considering biosecurity considerations as much as they should be when they're making funding decisions. And we'd like to really improve pre-funding biosecurity review. And the way that we're thinking about doing that is getting these funders to come forward and sign a biosecurity pledge, that's like make a public commitment to implement a more vigorous process for doing pre-funding biosecurity review, and also to develop tools to help these organizations actually do that. And figuring that out is not trivial. Figuring out what the process looks like that meaningfully reduces risk and is actually repeatable is hard to do. And so we really want to help with that. And so that's, and the reason we think that that's so valuable is because funders have so much leverage. And so if the funders really commit to this, this could have a lot of leverage across the community. The other thing I'll offer, which is something that's more on the horizon that we're really interested in, is thinking about the interface of artificial intelligence and biotech, and sort of what kind of capabilities are coming online as a result of that. I think it's been really interesting to see, DeepMind, for example, has developed AlphaFold, which predicts protein structure. I think what's coming is protein design. And that's a fundamental capability, as I mentioned during the talk. And I think we're going to have to, in my view, think about how do we safeguard those tools as well. So the model of DNA synthesis screening, where you screen orders and customers, is something that could be applied in other contexts. And I think we have a lot of work to do and opportunity to sort of figure out how to build that. And so we're pretty excited about exploring that as well.
Okay. Plenty of opportunities, it seems like, or plenty of different things that this model could tackle.
And I also want to emphasize that, I mean, we're going to try to build ideas, but lots of organizations can also spin up pilots. It doesn't have to be us. It could come from iGEM or the International Gene Synthesis Consortium or any number of other organizations that want to help build tools that IBIS could take on.
And I think the idea of the Funders Compact and also some of the other ideas on the list, including the idea of a biosecurity seal of approval, these are ideas that can be promulgated throughout different communities that experience biosafety and biosecurity in different ways. So certainly the biosecurity community, the EA community, the GCBR community can be out there talking about the importance of biosafety and biosecurity. We also need the global health community, the bioscience community, people who are coming at this from a different perspective to say, what can I do to actually show that my interest in biosafety and biosecurity? How can I get involved from where I sit? And both of those ideas, I think, are uniters that bring people into the conversation in ways that practically has been really hard to do in the past.
It sounds like through IBIS, you both will continue to have a lot of conversations with many different stakeholders. And I know you both also have experience interfacing with or directly for the U.S. government as a major stakeholder. So just to change tack a little bit, what's your experience in working on these long-term priorities, these long-termist priorities within a short-term oriented political system? And what's your strategy around that? How do you deal with the practical realities of working with that political system?
Yeah, it's a great question. We should probably both tackle it. So I view the two as not at all mutually exclusive. I think it's absolutely vital that policymakers are thinking about the long-term vision while they are looking at what is facing them day to day. I don't think we'll ever actually get prepared enough for things that we wouldn't call a GCBR, like the COVID-19 pandemic, if we're not actually at the same time preparing for a GCBR. Some of the packages of things that we need to be prepared for a pandemic that affects every community, every country on the planet, are the same types of things, that practical things that we need to have ready to go routinely to be able to spring into action extraordinarily quickly for a real GCBR. So I think that one of the things that we should do as a community is really not only make the case very clearly for why we need to be prepared for a GCBR, but at the same time making the case that that preparedness is going to help us enormously when we get hit with the next emerging local or regional outbreak or the next pandemic like COVID-19.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think in order to convince policymakers that we need to make certain investments that can help us with long-term goals, there has to be a hook for something that is like relevant in the near term. And I think that there's a little bit of push-pull here. I mean, I think the role that we have at NTI, and I think Beth in her various roles in government and outside of government, people in government, they have to think about the problem that's in front of them and that it's on fire today. That's their job. And as much as some of them might like to think about the long term, they don't always have the luxury of time. And so our job in the nonprofit community is to expand the horizons of these communities and help them think outside of the box and push them to think about the long term. Like what are the, not just like how do we deal with COVID, but what's the next pandemic and how might be different or bigger, and how can we think more comprehensively about the structures that we need to build so that we're prepared for the long term. And that's not only about a COVID-like event, but something that could be much bigger. So we're trying to think of, like, push people to expand their thinking, not only in terms of don't just respond to what's in front of you, be more expansive in your thinking, but also think that, understand that it could be much worse. And that's, I think that there's like a lot of bridging work that you need to do there. There's like a lot of, I think that there's a lot of value in sort of bridging conventional biosecurity thinking and conventional public health thinking with some of the values and ideas that are coming from this community. And I think in order to bring sort of establishment organizations along, we need to find a way to bring these ideas together and find common ground, as Beth was suggesting, so that we can get buy-in for some of the long-termist agenda items that we have. Like, what are the areas that we have shared interest? How can we make the case for building certain tools that we know will be helpful for reducing GCBRs and making the case that it's also useful for things, even if you're not bought into the idea that there could be an extinction risk to humanity, even if you just think there could be like a pandemic that's 10 times worse than COVID, can you convince those people to invest in certain capabilities that would guard against that, that also helps with GCBRs. So I think there's a lot of value in that kind of conversation.
I agree. And I think nomenclature is really important. And I've experienced throughout my career, many people in this audience have experienced throughout their careers, a migration of different types of nomenclature to include global health security, pandemic preparedness, biosecurity, biodefense, GCBRs. I don't define all of those things as the same, and neither do you, because you're thinking about them very specifically. But a lot of people who experience public policy in health security, and pandemic preparedness are looking at those terms as meaning the same thing. So sometimes it's just helpful to show the diagram of how GCBRs, pandemic preparedness, global health security, which I define as being prepared for any outbreak, whether naturally occurring, deliberate, or accidental, and then global health are not mutually exclusive. They're parts of an increasingly encompassing area of work, and that at the heart of it, if we're not prepared for the things that can really quickly affect everybody on the planet, we're going to, by definition, be less prepared for the other things. And so sometimes it's just sitting down and having that conversation with people who may not be as focused on your specific goal, but can experience why you care about it so much in the context of what they care about. So that nomenclature I find to be one of the most important things that we can really help unpack as a community. And I would really love to have more of a conversation with many people here and in the EA community about how we can do that better with policymakers, because I think it is a real missing piece that I've experienced even in my last stint in government most recently.
Mm-hmm. I think, so there's a question from the audience that really ties nicely to this, but I want to pose it in a way that is still optimistic, I think. So,
oh, goodness.
Well, so
there, we're optimists.
There's a trend within the EA community to really invite people like yourselves who interface with many other communities to offer your critiques or criticisms of what EA could do better. And it sounds like, especially with what you've done, interfacing with different communities, knowing the nomenclature, trying to bring those communities together, these are all ways that you think EA could improve. And are there other ways that you see that the EA biosecurity community could improve?
Yes. Okay. So I think that there's like a number of ways. So I think like I think there's tension between two goals in the community. On one hand, there's like a desire to sort of protect the purity and sanctity of this idea of guarding against existential risks, and we don't want to dilute that or somehow lose sight of the key goal. Like, you gotta keep your eyes on the prize. Like, this is what we're after, reducing GCBRs and countering existential risks, and we don't want to get bogged down in stuff that's not that. On the other hand, there's like a desire to, you know, learn from experts and influence existing institutions and like meet the world where it is. But I think that that's sometimes hard for the effective altruism community, because there's like sometimes a fear of engaging with the conventional community, like a distrust. Like, can I trust them? Are they spinning me? Are they trying to just get money? Do they really mean it? And I think I would encourage you to try to trust and try to like engage openly in conversations with people outside the community. I think that we can do, like, these communities can do the best work if we work together, because I think there's like really amazing, you know, decades of experience and expertise in the conventional community. And we've tried a lot of stuff that hasn't worked. And so there's a reason we try things in certain ways and not other ways. And the effective altruism community, I think the strength there is just really rigorous analytical thinking, like inherent skepticism, asking why this should be a priority and not that. How is that going to change the world? I think that's really powerful and it makes our work better. And you should keep bringing it and you should keep asking those questions. But if you don't engage with the conventional community, you try to stay separate, I think it's a huge missed opportunity. And I would encourage you to like to sort of give people a benefit of the doubt and to continue to have those conversations, even though sometimes it might be uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I'll just give an example of something that I think has been done really effectively, and also bringing it back to some of the work that's been done around IBIS. IBIS includes representatives from the global health community on its steering group. That was purposeful, and it was a purposeful engagement from literally pre-day one, like before the idea. We were at SB 7.0,
yeah.
Jamie and I, talking about the idea of a new organization focused on biosafety and biosecurity. And this huge auditorium at SB 7.0 is packed. And after the talk, people looked at us like we'd grown, you know, ahead. Well, why do we need a separate organization focused on this? And that was largely the technology, the synthetic biology community. But the same thing was happening in the global health community. You know, why do we need that? We have the WHO over here. We have the BWC over here. Well, guess what? The people who are funding biotechnology are the people who care about equitable distribution of biotechnology for the world. They care about development. They care about preventing pandemics. They care about preventing what's killing people day to day. And so if you want to get them interested in existential risk and what is going to end the planet, you have to engage them in this conversation. And so getting them engaged, I came back into the IBIS conversation after being in government and being recused from being in IBIS conversations because of my previous job recently, and just watching the work that's been done to actually, I don't want to use the word convert, but really change thinking in this community and really increase buy-in has been tremendous. And some of that is the COVID-19 pandemic, recognizing that what we thought we knew about this virus, we didn't know. It kept changing. It kept shifting. It, you know, many things that we didn't think were going to happen, including it still being here today, were not predictable. But part of it was just the engagement of that community. And so I do encourage you all to have those conversations, even though they're uncomfortable, and be part of them, because we cannot get to the goal that we have here without really, truly, deeply engaging them.
Great advice. Yeah. And well said. Thank you.
I know you both have experience working with the U.S. federal government, or working with them directly for them in various different capacities, and we're currently sitting in the capital of the United States. But we have a lot of folks at this conference who are not from the U.S., and one question from the audience is, you know, what would you, in your experience working on international consortia and things like that, what would you like to see from smaller countries? What are the opportunities there? Especially the question asks about U.S. allies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll make a general point. I think, you know, a lot of times there are questions from young people in the effective altruism community about how to get involved in biosecurity. And there's some people who think that you have to move to the United States and this is the only place to do biosecurity. And I really hope that people sort of, that they don't, I just don't think that's true. And I think the way that we're going to solve this problem is we have like really robust expertise in biosecurity institutions in countries around the world. Because of the history of funding and capacity building for around biosecurity and biosafety, a lot of that capacity resides in the United States. There's some in Western Europe, but not as much. And then in the other parts of the world, there's just a lot less. I think we should really work as a community or as a group of communities to change that. And I would love to see more NGOs focused on biosecurity in parts of Europe and other parts of the world. I would love to see more talent pipelines developed in other parts of the world, because fundamentally, you know, the United States can't unilaterally fix this problem. This is a global problem. If we don't have biosecurity safeguards around biotechnology in countries around the world, we're going to have huge glaring holes in our safety net. And that's just it's not going to work. So I think, when we go, for example, to the Biological Weapons Convention, we want to have a multilateral discussion about, can we agree as a international community to solve a problem? It's a consensus-based decision-making process. And if you don't have a lot of countries from different regions on board with the vision, it's not going to happen. Likewise, we have international meetings that we run at NTI and other organizations. We're always trying to think about how we get experts to the table that are from different countries and regions that can sort of share their perspective. And if there isn't expertise from those regions, there's no one at the table, and that's a problem. So I think if we can build our counterparts in other parts of the world, I think it's a long game and it's like a bigger bet, but I think that will just, in the long term, I think it will get us, it's more likely to get us to where we need to go than if we're just putting all our energy in the United States and Western Europe.
Yeah, and moreover, we just won't achieve the goal, period, full stop, if that's all we do. And I make just two comments. One, when you look at sort of allies and groupings of countries and where you can make a difference, the G7 and the G20 meet on average 10 times a year. That is a huge opportunity to keep the conversation of biosafety and biosecurity on the agenda. NATO meets regularly. That is a huge conversation. I mean, that is a huge opportunity to keep biosafety and biosecurity on the agenda. And many people who attend these conferences are coming from countries that participate in one or more of those groupings. The other thing that I would say, particularly about low and low middle income countries, where I think we need even more of attention on these issues and where actually a ton of champions exist, they're just not able to sort of get above the noise all of the time. People who live in low and low middle income countries have the most to lose in a fast moving emerging pandemic threat. And so you'll find when you engage with people one-on-one, including in ministries of health, where you might not expect people to care, they really actually do. They just need a lot of help figuring out how to build it in. And so when you look at tools that are considered conventional, like the WHO joint external evaluations, there is a whole section on biosafety and biosecurity. It's just helping those countries lift that up and make sure that it's part of what their governments care about. It's helping them get the political will to be able to move forward in those areas. But I don't find it to be a lack of interest. I find it to be more a lack of just being able to have the bandwidth that is needed to be able to focus on the issues, which again is a tremendous opportunity for grassroots work with those countries.
And while we're on the topic of other countries, I also want to specifically ask about how you two think about engaging with China, given that they're really becoming a powerhouse in the synthetic biology space. And are there any special or particular considerations you might want to share in terms of thinking about the relationship with China?
Sure. I mean, I think the relationship with China is critically important. And, you know, every time we raise the idea of IBIS or other international initiatives, one of the first questions that come up are like, what's China's opinion? Are they a part of your group? Do they support this? And, you know, part of that is because geopolitically China is so important, and also they have a really robust bioeconomy. They're, you know, one of the global leaders in bioeconomy and biotech. And I would say, you know, there's a lot of conversation that's like framing biotech development in very competitive terms, like U.S. competitiveness with China. I don't think that's particularly helpful frame, and I actually think it sets us back. I think it's more useful to think about it as like shared interests among the U.S. and China and globally. Like, we all have a shared interest in a safer world. We have a shared interest in building our respective bioeconomies and building the guardrails around them, and finding shared solutions to do that. And so anything that we do that sets it up as a competition, I think it makes it harder for us to have that conversation with China. And so that's not my take. I know other people are focused on that. That's not my focus. We just spend a lot of time trying to partner with China. And the other thing I'll say is we do have a representative from China both on our technical consortium for DNA synthesis screening, and they've been very engaged and very supportive, and also on our steering group for IBIS. We're really proud of that. We think that's important. We want to grow the relationship with Chinese experts on these issues because I think they have a lot to offer. We welcome the partnership.
I would just say that there is for sure all countries that are growing a bioeconomy need to be focused on biosafety and biosecurity, and China is no exception. I think there is definitely a frame of competition in our foreign policy relationship with between the United States and China. That's just a fact. We are competing. Let's compete to have great biosafety and biosecurity. That would be incredibly good for the world.
Great. Yeah, very important considerations to take into account. I think one thing that you mentioned in your presentation was that, I think you quoted from the Global Health Security Index, mm-hmm. that 94% of countries don't have current dual-use oversight, and you know, the U.S. has some policies around dual-use oversight, but I think that many have suggested that those are also could benefit from improvement. And going back to the U.S., do you feel like there's appetite within the U.S. for making those changes, or it's still difficult to persuade on that issue?
Do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. One, I think the United States should continually improve, and there's a lot of work ongoing right now that many of you are probably following, including what the National Science Advisory Board for Biosafety and Biosecurity is currently doing, and the recommendations that are out there from a number of groups, but put together by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security that you participated in. To actually look at places where improvements can be made. I think that's an incredibly productive and important conversation. I think it's also important to set norms for the world about what we should actually have in place countrywide around the world. When you look at only 6% of countries having any evidence of nationally based policies on life science dual use research of concern, that is a huge red flag. It doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to focus inwardly. It's not a zero sum game. We need to do our part here. We also really need to pay attention to how we're working with other partners to help them bring the norm up. And we need to bring it up in conversations that we're having with our partners all the time, because 6%, we know that the world has many more countries than 6% that are building bioeconomic strategies and building their bioeconomy. We also know that there's a lot of investments being made by funders, including funders that are funding development, funding sustainable development goals, biotechnologies, and new scientific endeavors in countries around the world that are part of that 94%. So it's really important that we look in and out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I think I would just add that, you know, the fact that there are 6% of countries that do have provisions in place, I don't think there's a single country anywhere in the world that has it all sorted out. This is a really hard problem. I mean, even the United States has been doing this for years. There's a ton of room for improvement. I'm glad the NSABB is tackling it. I hope that they'll be really forward-leaning and ambitious. I think there's both different camps with different views about how far we should go with it, and also just fundamentally it's a really hard set of problems to solve. And so I think it's just got to be continual iterative work in progress. I will say that seeing that the White House and the interagency also introduced new proposed guidelines for DNA synthesis screening is really exciting, and the draft that came out was very forward-leaning, which I think is a really positive reflection on the people behind the scenes that built that. Members of our technical consortium commented on that, as did a number of others in the community, and so we're eagerly looking to see how that will turn out. Part of the reason that guidance is really important is, to my knowledge, it's the only guidance that exists for DNA synthesis screening anywhere. And so while it is a U.S. guidance document, it has the de facto effect of being an international guidance document, because a number of companies from outside the U.S. that are members of the International Gene Synthesis Consortium do follow it. So there is like a leading by example role that the U.S. has played in the space.
And it's also not mandatory. The guidance is great, but it's not mandatory. There is no mandate that companies follow this guidance. And while many companies are absolutely doing the right thing and participating and trying to build, and that is critical and we should support that, it's also, when you look at what DNA synthesis can do, we should ask ourselves the question about whether all companies should have to do this.
Yeah.
I think they should.
I agree.
We have so many really excellent questions still pending, but I think we're going to have to wrap up. So I really just wanted to thank you both for joining us today and for your presentation, telling us more about the work you're doing and about IBIS. And yeah, everyone, if we can give a round of applause to our speakers. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.